that we are just a few days away from observing the festive celebration of Purim, and we have so many details to think about and to plan and to prepare for. As we know, Mishloach Manos is complicated, especially if you have young children and all of them want to go to their friends and their themes and their costumes and everything has to match. And we have Matanos LeEvyonim, which sounds pretty straightforward, but it's not so simple at all to really find somebody who qualifies for Matanos LeEvyonim and to give it to them and to make sure that you observe the mitzvah in the right way and the Seudas Purim and what are we going to eat in the Seuda and what are we not going to eat and who are we going to have it with, Mikra Megillah, which minyan are we going to daven in and which shul are we going to participate in, and yes, which shul are we going to go to. We should not be making private minyanim in our homes, because the Shulchan Aruch says from the Gemara, Berov Am Hadras Melech, we're supposed to read the Megillah together with many other people, so much so that the Gemara tells us that they were mevatel the avoda in the Beis Hamikdash, kidei l'shmoa mikra Megillah. They could have had a minyan in the Beis Hamikdash, but they chose to have all the Kohanim and Levim stop doing whatever they were doing to go to the local shul in Yerushalayim and be able to hear the Megillah. So when people spoke to me this week about all their questions about the house minyanim, the first question that I asked them is, why do you have a minyan in your house? If the avoda in the Beis Hamikdash was stopped in order to hear the Megillah in the shul, then I think we can make ourselves go a little bit out of our way to come to a Beis HaKnesses as well. Whichever shul you choose to go to, doesn't matter, but you should go Berov Am Hadras Melech, and you have to choose a Bal Koreh who you're actually going to be able to hear, not too much noise from the children. So make sure you plan accordingly and make sure that you have the opportunity during this very busy and hectic time. And I sometimes find that in the frenzy and all the busyness of Purim, we do not leave enough room to focus and concentrate our attention on the critical messages that we're supposed to be taking away from Megillas Esther. And I just wanted to dedicate this morning's shiur to that endeavor, to try to do as much as we can to take some kind of message from the Megillah. But before we begin, I have to give credit to someone by the name of Tzachi Trachtengut, who I do not know, but a number of years ago, he wrote an article that was published in Eretz Yisrael. He wrote it in Hebrew. I was very taken by it. It was in one of these publications that I happened to get in the mail. Usually I don't read them, but I saw something interesting and I read it. I wrote down many of his comments and I was very taken by the themes, and that inspired much of what I will be talking about today. So the Megillah is a familiar story to all of us. But the truth is that the details of the historical context of the Megillah are really obscure. They're a little bit ambiguous to us, and we don't really understand exactly what they are. The truth is, when you look through many of the Nevi'im, we don't always know exactly the context or the history behind each of the Nevi'im. It's not always outlined so clearly who their friends were, who their contemporaries were, where they lived. Let's say, take for example, Sefer Iov, where we really don't know at all. The Rambam says Iov never lived at all. Iov just is a fictional character. Other Rishonim say he lived here, he lived there, he lived in this period of history, that period, but it doesn't really matter, because the messages of Sefer Iov and of all the Nevi'im are timeless, they are enduring, and it really should not matter to us at all when the Navi happened to live, or who his friends may have been or not, because the messages that they conveyed are ones that we can always take with us, and we can always learn. Megillas Esther is very unique in the fact that we are introduced to the Megillah with a very clear introduction of exactly when this happened. And we are told, Vayihi bimei Achashverosh, which obviously means, if the Megillah goes out of its way to highlight that this is when it happened, it means that that is a very significant point for all of us to be aware of. It's not just a historical point. It means that it's important for us to appreciate what the story is all about by knowing that piece of information. So let's just try to understand. The first Rashi on the Megillah writes, who was Achashverosh? Vayihi bimelech Achashverosh, says Rashi, Melach Paras haya. Achashverosh was the king of Persia. Shemalach tachas Koresh. He took over the mantle of leadership after Koresh, who was the first king of the Persian Empire. Lesof shivim shana shel galus Babel. This happened at the end of the 70-year period of the exile of the Jews who were living in Babel, outside of Eretz Yisrael. That is what Rashi tells us. So let's give a little bit of a context. Let's just understand that a little bit more. Koresh, as we mentioned, was the first king of the Persian Empire. Koresh gave permission to the Jews to go back to Eretz Yisrael after they were in exile for 70 years. He gave them this allowance to move back to Eretz Yisrael and to rebuild a Beis HaMikdash. This is outlined in the Psukim in Sefer Ezra and Sefer Nehemiah. The Navi Yeshaya talks about it, so much so that the Navi Yeshaya refers to Koresh as Mashiach. He's the one who saved the Jewish people. He's the one who gave the allowance for them to return to their homeland, to rebuild once again the Beis HaMikdash. And the truth is, when you just back up a step, the Navi Yirmiyah tells us before the whole galus happened, before the whole exile went into effect, they were promised from the outset how long this would last. So the Navi says as follows, Navi Yirmiyah Perek Chafei, V'haysa kala aretz azos lecharva. This entire land of Eretz Yisrael will be decimated and destroyed. L'shama, v'avdu ha'gayim ha'ele es melech babel shivim shana. And you will all be under the mantle of leadership of foreign nations. You will not have your own government. And then, v'haya kimlo shivim shana, after 70 years has passed, efkod al-melech babel, I will then give the divine inspiration to the king of Babel, who was Koresh, and allow him to bring all of you back to Eretz Yisrael. That was before the Churban Beis HaMikdash. They were told that this is what's going to happen. The Navi Yirmiyah writes again, a few parakim later, Ka'amar Hashem, lefi malos debavel shivim shana, after 70 years of being outside of Eretz Yisrael, efkod eschem v'hakimosi aleichem es devari hatov lahashiv eschem ala makam azeh. The Navi talks about this in Yirmiyah, in Yeshaya, in Sefer Daniel. Over and over again, the Nevi'im described this allowance that we were going to be given to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Now, aside from the logistical problems and challenges that they were going to face in going back to Eretz Yisrael and building a Beis HaMikdash, there happened to be a number of halachic obstacles and challenges as well that the Acharonim discuss. For example, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, and the Rambam clearly paskins this way, that the only way to build a Beis HaMikdash is when you have a Melech al Yisrael, when you have a Jewish king leading the Jewish people. Well, at that time, there was no Jewish king. Yes, they were allowed to go back to Eretz Yisrael, but there was no king leading the charge. So what right did they have to even start this process of building a Beis HaMikdash? That's a major question, a big impediment that you have to think about. A second issue is, the Sefer Achinuch writes that we do not have an individual obligation to build a Beis HaMikdash. It is not anyone can point a finger at anyone else and say, you now have an obligation to build a Beis HaMikdash. This is an obligation that is on the tzibur of Klal Yisrael. It is an obligation that rests upon all of our shoulders as a whole. And the Sefer Achinuch writes that the only time we have this obligation is when you have Rov Yisrael Shruyim Al Admasam, when you have most of the Jewish community living in the land of Eretz Yisrael, which was definitely not the case in the time of Ezra. The Psukim in Sefer Ezra tell us that when the allowance was given to go back to Eretz Yisrael, there was a very poor response. They did not respond positively at all. In fact, it says that when Ezra goes to the border of Eretz Yisrael and he's about to enter, he turns around and he tries to make a count. Do we even have enough Kohanim? Were we to build a Beis HaMikdash, do we have enough people here, enough Kohanim, enough Levim, to run a functioning system in the Beis HaMikdash? And they did not have. He turned back around and he starts asking whether they can have more volunteers. This was a very poor response, which should be of no shock to us living in this generation, where we have the same. God has given an incredible gift to our generation, something that our grandparents and great-grandparents could never have dreamt of having, this absolute dream or possibility of living in Eretz Yisrael, and yet most of the Jews still live in Chutz La'aretz. Now, some have legitimate reasons to live in Chutz La'aretz. Most of us probably have illegitimate reasons and just giving excuses, myself included. And it's hard for us to really wrap our heads around the fact that we are a nation that's being given the opportunity to experience our own geula, to live in our own country, to live in our own land. And we have not listened to that as effectively as the Jews probably should have. But that is the story that occurred in the days of Ezra. That is the backdrop of what happened at the times of the Megillah story. And that's what I think is important for us to really understand. And Sefer Divrei HaYamim, it recounts, the psukim there describe the magnanimous offers of Koresh to the Jewish community at the time in their ability to return to Eretz Yisrael. So the psukim say that it was in the first year of the rulership of Koresh, Heir Hashem es ruach Koresh melech paras. It's an amazing way to understand this. Heir Hashem es ruach Koresh melech paras. Understand that when a president of the United States allows us to move an embassy and recognize Yerushalayim as the capital, it's because Heir Hashem es Einei HaPresident. It's exactly what happens. It's not that a president just comes up with a great idea. It's that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who has people working for him, who has emissaries all over the world in every country and every continent. Lev Melachim Biyad Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who makes decisions on behalf of world leaders. And that is what we need to think about now as well. I promised I wouldn't talk about Ukraine, but I guess I'm breaking my promise. I'm sorry, Chani. But we are told that Hashem ish milchama. It's what we say every day. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who runs all affairs in the world, including milchama. So as difficult as that is to process, and as hard as it is for us to understand, why would he do such a thing? Why would he want innocent civilians to be killed? And why would he want so many refugees to be displaced? And why would he want so many people having a traumatic experience? And all of us giving money, and all of us standing on our heads to try to figure out how to be helpful? All of that is a good question. But remember, at the heart and the essence of all of that is Hashem ish milchama. So the psukim say here that the same was in the days of Koresh. It's not because he was so righteous, and it's not because he was so lovely, but rather it's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him the schus to be the one to give the permission, to give the allowance to the Jewish people at the time to go back. And he sends out a proclamation to the entire dynasty, letting everyone know that the Jews now have the right to go back. Nasan li Hashem Elokei HaShamayim, v'hu pakad alai livnos lo bayis b'Yerushalayim asher b'Yehuda. God has entrusted me to build a Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim and to allow the Jews to go back. And that was an amazing moment. That was a defining moment in Jewish history. So, unfortunately, the leadership of Koresh was very short-lived. He only ruled for 3 years, at which point he passes away, and then Ahasuerus takes over. And that leads us straight into the story of the Megillah, Vayihi Bimei Ahasuerus. So that's just the background. Tragically, as we mentioned, the Jewish community responded very poorly to this call, to this phenomenon, to this reality of a Geula. And they were very unenthusiastic, and they were inattentive to the calling. And Ezra was the Navi at the time, trying to galvanize the people, and people were really not interested at all. They were totally, totally disinterested. The Gemara seems to say that this was a calculated decision on their part. This was a conscious decision. It was not something that just happened by mistake. The leaders, the Talmidei Chachamim, the dignitaries of the time, all made a choice to stay behind in Galus. Why? So it seems from the Gemara that the reason why is because they felt that since the citadels of Torah, since the epicenter of Torah study was at that point in history outside of Eretz Yisrael, they felt Gedola Talmud Torah Yoser Mi Binyan Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says such a statement from Rav that Talmud Torah is considered to be greater than the mitzvah of building a Beis HaMikdash, which is an amazing statement for the Gemara to make. But that is what they felt, that Talmud Torah is better than Binyan Beis HaMikdash, which is something to think about as well today. Obviously, we all have a dream, or we need to have an aspiration and a dream of living in Eretz Yisrael, but at what cost? What are we willing to sacrifice for it? So Eretz Yisrael is a Jewish country, and there's a amazing sense of belonging and understanding of all the Yamim Tovim and Shabbos when you're living in Eretz Yisrael. It's not the same as it is in Chutz Laretz, but at the same time, it doesn't work for everybody. And certain children are going to have to compromise their chinuch. Obviously, certain ones are going to be doing very well and they're going to integrate into the system, but others might not. And as a result of that, there are many families who make a decision that Gedola Talmud Torah, that Talmud Torah is greater, and making sure that my children are going to be raised in the proper way that I want them to be raised, in a Torah value way. If I think that the odds of that happening in Chutz La'aretz are going to be greater than Eretz Yisrael, there's a lot to consider. There's a lot to think about. It's not so simple. It's not true that the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael overrides everything else. It's not the case. And that's what happened in the days of Ezra, that the priority, the preference was given to learning Torah versus building Eretz Yisrael. And that is really what happened. You know, Rav Soloveitchik writes, after the Shoah, he had an amazing response, which he wrote, Kol Dodi Dofek, which became a very famous essay of Rav Soloveitchik. But basically what he was describing was that the whole story in Shir HaShirim is when you have a couple, when you have a husband, a wife, each one is looking for the love of the other, and they keep missing each other. And it's a devastating story. But Rav Soloveitchik said there are some times when the beloved knocks on the door and waits for a response. And how could you just ignore the call? And he said, as he was watching history unfold in the last 80 years, he was saying that we had a devastating blow in the Shoah, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu was knocking at the door, Kol Dodi Dofek, that the Ribono Shel Olam is knocking at our door and asking for us to respond, and giving us the gift of Eretz Yisrael, and he's waiting to see, will we react, will we respond? And that sometimes is the experience of the Jew in exile, of the Jew in Galus, trying to figure out when is the appropriate time and what am I supposed to sacrifice for this opportunity of Geula, for this opportunity that God is giving me of being a part of the story of Eretz Yisrael, being part of the people of Eretz Yisrael. So the Jews at the time really remained behind for the most part. They did not go along with Ezra. And there were clusters, pockets of Jewish communities strewn about throughout the dynasty of the Persian Empire. And that is what the Pasuk says in the Megillah. Nikalu ha-Yehudim ba'areihem b'chol medinos ha-melech Achashverosh. What does that mean? It means the Jews gathered together in their cities under the leadership of Achashverosh. They were strewn about all over. There were Jewish communities everywhere, just like we have today. In every continent, in every country, there's a Jewish community that is not really connected to the Jews in other continents or other countries or other cities, but that is what happened. There were Jews everywhere in the land in the Persian Empire. In fact, the Gemara tells us that the Jews at the time were punished as a result of the lack of interest that they had in Geulas Eretz Yisrael, in Binyan Beis Hamikdash. So the Gemara tells us in Brachos Daf Dalet, Ru'uyim hayu Yisrael la'asos lahem neis bimei Ezra, kederach sha'asa lahem bimei Yehoshua ben Nun. In the days of Yehoshua ben Nun, when he came back into Eretz Yisrael, so we're told that Jericho's walls fell down, spectacular miracles, a dramatic scene that everybody experienced, and the same kind of experience was supposed to happen when the Jews were to return in the days of Ezra. What happened? Writes the Gemara, Garam hachet. Unfortunately, the Jewish people violated a sin, and as a result of that, this possibility was taken away from them. What was that sin? What did they do wrong? And Rashi says what they did wrong was that they were indifferent, that they had a complete sense of carelessness toward this opportunity of Geulas Eretz Yisrael, of Binyan Beis Hamikdash. And as a result of that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to switch the plan because we were unworthy of having that opportunity of experiencing the same kind of miracles that Yehoshua ben Nun did when he came into the land of Eretz Yisrael. So they have a group of Jews with Ezra who come to the land of Israel. They start with the process of building the Beis Hamikdash. The locals who lived in Eretz Yisrael at the time objected to this possibility. They were very opposed. They did not want the Jewish community to then have their own Beis Hamikdash, their own palaces, their own governments, their own capital. They were very uncomfortable with that. And they petitioned the Persian government that they should stop immediately all of these efforts toward building a Beis Hamikdash. They send letters to Achashverosh and they ask him to please get in the way, to block and to cancel all of the permission that he gave until then. So if it was not bad enough that the Jewish community had a very poor showing when they came to Eretz Yisrael, even worse, the Jews who did go and were trying to invest of themselves and build the Beis Hamikdash were now stopped in their tracks right when Achashverosh takes over. He stops them from being involved in the process of building a Beis Hamikdash. Okay, so we read the Megillah, and it seems almost as if the struggle between Haman and Mordechai is one which is the result of some kind of run-in that they have. So Mordechai is living in Shushan Habira, and he comes across Haman, and everyone's bowing down, and Mordechai is the only one, lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai is the only one who refuses to go along with what everyone else is doing. And he came to hate and to despise his counterpart. But the truth is, Chazal tell us, this is a relationship that had a history to it as well. This is nothing new. The story that we just mentioned, the Jews are building the Beis Hamikdash in Yerushalayim, and somebody objects to their building. The Medrash says those were the Aseres B'nai Haman who petitioned Achashverosh. They petitioned the Persian government at the time to stop the allowance of building a Beis Hamikdash. So Achashverosh hears from some citizens that they were very uncomfortable with this. He hears from the Jewish community in Israel that they very much are excited about this, and he does not know exactly what to do. So the Medrash tells us the following. Vayimalei Haman Chema. When Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman, so we're told that Haman's reaction is vitriol. He's just so hurt. He's so upset. And the Medrash tells us, why is that? Lo lechinam hayu miskotetim. This was a long-standing, deep-seated, established conflict between Haman and Mordechai. How so? Kishahayu Yisrael bonim chomos Yerushalayim bimei Ezra. When the Jews in Eretz Yisrael were building the Beis Hamikdash, bo aleihem hasonim. the haters of the Jewish community came along, the Amru Lahem, and they accused them of building Shalom Bershus HaMelech. They accused them of illegal construction. And they sent petitions. V'heim omrim, ein anu bonim ela bershuso. What do you mean we're illegal? We did this all under the allowance from Koresh, and Achashverosh honored that permission. And that's all we're doing. So at the time, the two sides decided that they have to each send a representative to negotiate in Persia with Achashverosh whether or not this plan is going to continue or whether it has to be stopped. And the two representatives, the Medrash says, that were sent were Haman and Mordechai. Both of them were living in Eretz Yisrael at the time. Both of them were then sent back to negotiate on the behalf of the Jews and the rest of the community in Israel whether or not this would be a possibility going forward. And that's a fascinating color to the story of the Megillah. So when you read the pasuk in the Megillah and you're told that Mordechai was Asher Haglam Yerushalayim Im Hagola Asher Haglasa, we read that in the tune of Eicha, that Mordechai was taken out of Yerushalayim. That means he aspired to live in Yerushalayim. He tried to go back and build a life in Yerushalayim. And unfortunately, he was then sent back to live in Galus once again. And that was a devastating time. So what emerges is that the nature of the difficult relationship here in the Megillah is not just a personal one. It is one that is firmly rooted in the story of Binyan Beis HaMikdash, in the story of Jewish identity in Eretz Yisrael, and the right of the Jews to experience a geula. And that is the essence, that's the heart, that is the foundation of this toxic relationship between Haman and his counterpart and his adversary, Mordechai. So this is the opening scene of the Megillah. Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. That's all in three words. Then we go to the next part of the Megillah and we're told of the details of Mishte Achashverosh. Now, you read the psukim and you get a sense of a little bit of what was going on. You look in the Gemara and Megillah and you are told a little bit more. This was a blowout feast, a banquet that was so over-exaggerated. It was so extravagant. I mean, there are many people in this room who probably have what to celebrate in their lives, I would hope. But a celebration can only last so long. Shmonim uma'as yom, 180 days of festive celebration, the entire country. And the Gemara outlines and describes exactly what was being served there. An assortment of every delicacy, of every drink, of every kind of food. It was kosher food. They weren't eating non-kosher food. It says, Hashtia chadas ein ones. Nobody was forced. You want to have a drink? Have a drink. You like this kind of dessert? Have it. You rather have the healthy option? Go to the other side of the room. No problem. Everything was available. Everything was there. Gourmet chefs overindulging. 180 days. Think about that. What happened to the economy? 180 days. Nobody went to work? We don't think about it when we read the Megillah, but what was happening? How could it be that everybody in the entire country under the rulership of Achashverosh was just partying all day and night without any end in sight? And that is something that is a little bit curious, but the Gemara also seems to say that the date that was chosen for this party was not arbitrary at all. This was not at random. There was a very specific reason why the celebration commenced when it did. And that was that Achashverosh, I'm sometimes embarrassed to think about this because Achashverosh seemingly knew Tanakh better than we do. So it says that Achashverosh is looking in the words of the Nevi'im, and he sees that God promises the Jewish people that after 70 years, they're going to be able to go back to Eretz Israel. And he starts making all the calculations and he says, it's been 70 years and this is not going to happen. The Jews seem to be here to stay. Never will they be blessed with having the opportunity to go back to Eretz Israel and build their own country and their own land. And finally, this party, this Mishteh Achashverosh, is really meant as a means of celebrating that dream of Geula coming to a close. It was an opportunity for them to realize that the aspiration of being Jews once again in our own land and having our own set of values and rules would be something that is an impossibility. And Achashverosh celebrated that. And we're told in the Megillah V'kelim mikelim shonim, that part of the vessels that he used to celebrate at this banquet were old vessels. What does it mean he used old vessels? We lane that in the tune of Eicha, because it's really a reference to the kelim from the Beis HaMikdash. Until this point, Ahasuerus was nervous. He was scared. I'm not going to touch anything that belongs to the Beis HaMikdash. Who knows what's going to happen? At this point, he realized Beis HaMikdash is a relic of the past. It's a piece of history. Never again will we have that opportunity to have a Beis HaMikdash. So let's use the kelim. Let's all join together and celebrate the downfall of the Jewish people, that they will never again be identified as the Am HaNivchar. They will never again be the Am Segula. Never again will they have the opportunity to be united, rallying around the Beis HaMikdash. And this really explains why it was looked at as such an objectionable move for any Jew to accept the invitation to go to Mishteach HaShveirosh. It was not the fact that he was throwing a party. Again, there were kosher food. There was everything there. This was a celebration of the complete assimilation of the Jewish people into the Persian culture. A celebration of the fact that never again would they have a Jewish identity. Never again would they be able to live by the standards and the values of what Jewish communities are supposed to look like. So, if it was not bad enough that the Jewish people did not heed the call of Ezra and go back to Eretz Yisrael when they were given the opportunity, now we see the Jewish community digging in their heels and celebrating the fact that they no longer believed in the possibility of a redemption. No longer did they believe in the possibility of any return to Eretz Yisrael. And the tragedy of that was not only that they lost out on the possibility of being in Eretz Yisrael, but also that the aspiration of a Jew being free, the aspiration of a Jew being a part of the Jewish community, is something that was a devastating blow at the time. The Chasam Sofer, I mentioned it in the past, but the Chasam Sofer makes a historical observation. Chasam Sofer made this observation 200 years ago, at least. But it's so prophetic. His words are so profound. If you just study Jewish history at a most basic level, you'll see how true it is. Chasam Sofer writes, Bavon Hosseinu HaRabim Anu Roim, we see the cycle of life in Jewish communities come back and repeat itself over and over again. And he says, Achar Shenechshechu Enei Yisrael Kama Zmanim Be'oni V'Galus. We go through a difficult period where we are not just looked down upon, but we are destroyed as a people. V'nimasu Kikutzim Be'enehem. And we become like thorns in the eyes of our neighbors. Uposchem Lahem K'sash Sharei Rachmim. And after the atrocities that befall the Jewish people, after that, a small aperture opens up and they start to appreciate the value of religious freedoms, the cause of the Jewish people. Umamshichem osam umarim lahem ktsas panim shochakos. And when that happens, opportunities begin to open up for the Jewish people. Vechashuche hagalos ha'elu ber osam ar. And as a people, when we start to see this possibility of being accepted by our host mother country, Nispatu v'nimshachim v'choshvim l'hiskari v'yoser v'yoser. We get more and more entrenched and more involved in the community where we are. V'ochlim mipitam v'shosim miyenam v'choshvim al yidei zeh limsochein. And we think that we are going to be accepted. Look at the Biden administration that has a religious woman working as the head of the cybersecurity unit. She's part of the cabinet of the President of the United States, a girl who grew up in Borough Park. It's amazing. Chani Neuberger, right? She goes by Anne. She's Chani Carfunkel from Borough Park. It's an amazing phenomenon. And we look at every level of government, and we have representatives, and we have great relationships, and we are accepted. And sometimes when that happens, we forget what it means to have a Jewish identity. We forget what it means to be who we know we are supposed to be. Avraham Avinu, we're told, is referred to as Avraham. And the reason why the Psukim say is because he was referred to as Av Hamon Goyim, which means Avraham Avinu was expected to be cosmopolitan. He was supposed to be a global international figure who took an interest and got involved in everything that happened in the entirety of the world. All of that was supposed to be a part of him. And yet at the same time, Avraham Avinu, it's almost paradoxical, is told to perform a bris milah on himself and his children. How can that be? You're now separating yourself. You're making yourself different. And the answer is that that is the contradictory values, the conflicting values that a Jew always needs to live with what it means to have a conscience of a Jew, to have morals of a Jew, to understand that I have a bris milah, that I am different, that I live by different values and different rules. But at the same time, I'm av hamon goyim, I am involved, I'm fully integrated, I am taking interest in everything that goes on in the world. It's part of my challenge, but it's hard to strike the perfect balance. And this is where the Jewish community at the time in Persia made a major mistake. And the Chasam Sofer writes, this is what happens in every generation. We watch that cycle repeat itself over and over again as the Jews then become accepted and they become proud citizens of whatever country they're in, and they're prosperous, and they're successful, and they're fully integrated. They then lose that sense of belonging. They lose that sense of understanding of who they are and what they represent. Just look what's going on in our world. So it's nice that we have enclaves of pockets of Orthodox communities all over the country. But think about the assimilation rate. We don't think about it often enough, but how many Jews are we losing every single day? Just because we have lost the sense of understanding of what it means to be belonging to the Jewish community, what it means to be a part of the Am Segula, part of the Am HaNivchar. So it seems, Chazal tell us, that one of the critical components to a Geula is Jewish unity, is feeling that sense of belonging and understanding. And the Medrash says in Bereishis Rabbah, Nasu b'nei Yisrael aguda achas, if you see that the Jewish people are living in harmony, if they're living with unity, Haskinu atzmachem legeula, then get ready for a redemption. And it seems almost as if that is a precondition to what a redemption requires of all of us. We talk about Yerushalayim, but the way the Navi describes it is Yerushalayim habnuya ki ir shechubra la yachdav. It's the place, like the Gemara says, shenasu kulam chaverim ze la ze. Yerushalayim is the ultimate unifier. It's the place where all of us need to feel comfortable and where we need to make others feel comfortable as well. That is what Geula requires of us. So much so that the Medrash contrasts the generation of Achav with the generation of David HaMelech. Achav, the Psukim tell us in great detail, was the worst of kings that ever lived for the Jewish people. And Achav murdered all the Nevi'im. Achav served Avodah Zarah and encouraged others to do the same. And we're told in the Pasuk in Sefer Melachim that Achav did things that angered HaKadosh Baruch Hu more mikol Malchei Yisrael asher hayu lefanav. He angered the Ribbono Shel Olam more than any king who ever came before him. And yet, with all of that, serving Avodah Zarah, murdering the Nevi'im of his generation, we are told that when Achav went out to war, he was victorious. He was successful in battle. How can that be? Asked the Medrash. Contrast that with David HaMelech. If you ever read through Tehillim with the English, you'll see that David HaMelech lost many, many wars in his life, many failures. Why is it that Achav had the possibility of being triumphant? Why was he able to be victorious? Whereas David HaMelech lost so many times in his attempts at battle. And the answer that the Medrash gives is, because in the days of Achav, as much as they served Avodah Zarah, as much as they may have done things wrong, they were a unified front. They were united in their cause. And that was their schus, that was their merit. And you contrast that with David HaMelech when we're told that there was so much division. It was a disjointed nation in the days of David HaMelech. And as a result of that, David HaMelech was not able to be the one to win those battles. That was the claim, that was the greatest vulnerability against the Jewish people at the time, which in fact is the assertion of Haman against the Jewish people. So when Haman goes and puts a claim against the Jews into Achashverosh, what does he say? Yeshno am echad mefuzar u'mefurad bein ha'amin. What does that mean? It means we have a nation here, the Jewish people, who are scattered, who are dispersed, who have no sense of unity at all, who are disconnected with each other. Many Mefarshim explain that that's what it means. And really, the pretext to any sort of geula, to any sort of redemption, is that we need to participate. We need to do something to show that we are worthy of a geula. We need to show that we appreciate what it means to be the Am that is about to be redeemed. And that is what Haman says against the Jewish people, that we are mufuzar and mufurad bein ha'am, and we don't have that sense of unity. That is what we lacked at the time. It's interesting because when you look at Geulas Mitzrayim, when you look at what happened when we came out of Egypt, so we know Chazal tell us we were on the Memtesh Shari Tumah, lowest of the low. The Jewish people had nothing going for them at all. And God said, you know, I don't expect anything of you. Hashem yilachem lachem ve'atem tacharishun. You stay back. You keep quiet. You don't need to do anything actively to be involved in this. I will do everything on your behalf. And then you contrast that with all subsequent Geulas. The Maharal writes, you know, when you have a child who's 6 months old, you don't expect the child to do anything to help themselves. They're not going to change their own diapers. They're not going to clean up after themselves. They're not going to make themselves breakfast or lunch. You as the parent, you as the caretaker, need to do everything for the child. But as they mature, there's an expectation. And as they grow older, the expectation begins to grow as well. So when they're 10 years old, the expectation is I'm not going to have to put on their sneakers every day when they go out, and I don't have to get them dressed. They know how to get dressed themselves, and they know how to give themselves a bath or a shower. And at some point, they know how to take care of themselves in many different ways. Obviously, as a parent, I still need to be involved, and I'm still taking care of them, and I'm still paying tuitions. Maybe by the time they're going for their second master's, when they're 30 years old, it's time for them to start paying their own tuition. And it's time for them to get their own apartment. And it's time for them to move out and make a life for themselves because they need to be independent. And there's more of an expectation that I have as a person continues to mature and grow. It's the way it works in the world. It's the way it's supposed to work. There's a trust that our caretakers have in us when we get to certain milestones and stages in our own life. And so says the Maharal, it went with the maturation of the Jewish people. When we came out of Mitzrayim in the infant stages of who we were, Hashem said, I have no expectation of you at all. Hashem yilachem lachem ve'atem tacharishun. You're little children. You don't know how to clean up after yourselves. You don't know how to do anything. I'm going to do it all for you. I'm going to be the caretaker, the caregiver. But as they matured, God says, I need some participation. I do have an expectation of you. As we've matured over the last few thousand years, it's time for the Jewish people to say, we are a mature people at this point, and we need to participate in the process of Geula. And we need to do something to show HaKadosh Baruch Hu that Geula is a realistic possibility for all of us. And it's something that's not just a dream or an aspiration, but it's real. It's something that we sincerely believe in, and it's something that we really want. And Mordechai, as the leader of his time, had one particular and singular focus, and that was, as the leader, he needed to figure out how to get the Jewish people to be together, to feel that sense of togetherness. How is he going to get them to be interested or worthy of experiencing a geula once again? How would Mordechai be able to galvanize the people to reclaim their own identity? How would they be able to feel a sense of Jewish pride again, of being the Am Segula, of being the Am HaNivchar, when it seems that at the beginning of the story, they were doing everything but that? They were celebrating their sense of assimilation. They were celebrating the disappearance of the Jew. They were celebrating the fact that we no longer have the possibility of Geula. And that was his challenge. That was everything that he sought to do in his involvement in the Jewish people at the time. As the story unfolds, we watch how Esther is put into this very precarious situation. And she is encouraged by Mordechai to negotiate on behalf of the Jewish people. And at first, Esther's concern is for her own well-being, for her own safety. And she's totally unprotected, completely vulnerable. And she's worried, and she expresses that to Mordechai. What's going to be? I'm going to die if I go ahead and put myself out there. At which point, Mordechai understands and appreciates her comment, but he says to her, listen, this is an unusual time in Jewish history. This is a moment, this is an opportunity for you. And what is the Tzav HaShaah? This is a question that Jews in every generation need to ask themselves. What is the Tzav HaShaah? What is this moment expecting of me as an individual? What am I supposed to be doing? How should I respond? And Mordechai says, what we need right now is people who understand and appreciate that they need to put forth a steadfast commitment. They need to have an unshakable belief in who the Jewish people are and the greater good of the Jewish people as a whole. Vayomer Mordechai lahashiv el Esther, Al tidami b'nafshech lihimaleit beis hamelech mikol hayehudim. Don't think that you can hide in the palace and live out a good life there. That's not what this moment calls for. Ki em acharesh tacharishi be'es azos. if you will not appreciate the calling of this moment. Rebach v'hatzalah ya'amod la'yehudim mimakom acher. You will become irrelevant. At ubeis avich tovedun. Nobody will ever talk about Esther again, because you are an irrelevant figure in Jewish history. What this moment in Jewish history expects of all of us, with the tremendous courage that it took of her, and with the unbelievable bravery and focus that Esther had at the time, Mordechai explains that what you need to do now is show your sense of pride for what it means to be a part of the Jewish people, because that's what's lacking right now. And as the leader of the Jewish community, that is everything that Mordechai needed to accomplish, to make the Jews once again feel and reclaim their own sense of pride and their own sense of belonging to each other. It should be of no coincidence that once Esther agrees to make this decisive decision to go in and to negotiate on behalf of the people, she asks for one thing. Lech kenos es kol ha'yehudim. Gather the people. If I am putting myself out there, all for Jewish pride and all for the Jewish people, then I expect that you will mobilize and galvanize the Jewish people to do the same, to feel that sense of Jewish pride, to once again reclaim their sense of unity and show how much they care about each other. And that really is the subtext, the undertone of the entire Megillah. It starts with a people who do not have a Jewish identity, who lose their sense of understanding and appreciation for what it means to be a part of the Jewish people. And throughout the Megillah, what we find is one attempt after the next to try and galvanize the Jewish people to reclaim their own sense of identity and to appreciate their value in the context of the Jewish community. In fact, when the tables turn and Ahasuerus offers immunity and protection to the Jewish people, what does he say? He gives them the opportunity, lihikahel v'la'amod al nafsham. Lihikahel v'la'amod al nafsham. How are they going to defend themselves? By becoming a tzibur once again. By uniting once again, lihikahel, to come together and appreciate what it means to live a life being together. That was the transformation. That was the metamorphosis that occurred from starting the Megillah as being mefuzer and mefurad bein ha'amim, to then going through this journey and landing in a place of Lech Kenos as Kala Yehudim, Lihi Kahel Vala Amod Al Nafsham. And that is what, as we read the Megillah, I think it's an opportunity for all of us to think about. How much do we feel a sense of Jewish pride, and how much are we willing to show that we care about who the Jewish people are, putting that in front of our own interests, putting that in front of ourselves? How much are we willing to sacrifice on behalf of the Jewish people? How much are we willing to put out for the sake of the betterment of the Jewish community and stop being so self-centered? That is the transformation that occurs in the pages of the Megillah. It's what we watch from one chapter to the next. It's the subtext. If you look back at the story, you'll see that this is the entire storyline. It's not mentioned explicitly, but as you pay attention, you'll notice this is the takeaway message of what the Megillah is all about. And it should be of no surprise at all to us that the entire way that we commemorate this holiday, the Megillah describes for us, is lasos osam yimei mishte v'simcha, mishloach manos ish l'reyeu matanos l'avyonim. The way that we commemorate this holiday is by strengthening our relationships with other Jews. It's by reuniting, by showing that we care about the poor who lives in our community. It's by showing that we care about others who may have been neglected. You know, my children always choose certain kids in their class who they're going to go to. Obviously, we can't go to all of them. So whatever number we give them, we say to each, whatever, you can choose 10 friends, 15 friends, whatever, I don't care, it doesn't matter to me at all. But I always tell them, you have to choose at least 5 who you think no one else is going to go to. Choose your 10 closest friends, it's fine. But at least 5 of them, on top of that, need to be kids who are not going to be visited by others. That is the mitzvah of Mishloach Manos, that's what it is. It's not to have a party with our friends and give them candy and make them have cavities and have fun. The point is that we should make a sense of unity. We should make people feel that they belong to what it means to be a part of the Yam HaNimchar, the Yam Segula. And every year, I'm so proud that my children, every year in Darche, where they go to school, actually every Sunday and every legal holiday, they have many special needs individuals who come from all the local public schools, come to Darche, and are integrated into the classrooms. And I always encourage my kids, maybe it's different for them because we go to Camp Simcha in the summer, so they are not as stigmatized against things that other children may be afraid of. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I always encourage my children that they should be the ones to sit next to these kids in the class when they come on Sundays, and if they need help doing certain things, they should be involved. And every year, my kids always make a point on Purim to visit those kids and to bring them something special. And I was so proud because last year my son went back to school and told all his friends, "Do you know that I went to visit this kid?" Actually, 2 years ago. Last year, he came back to me and said that every kid in the class went because of what he told them. That's what Purim is. Yimei mishtev esimcha, mishloach manos matanos le'avyonim. Think about the person who is not going to have it. This is not a status. Nobody needs to go to anyone else's house. We don't need this. What we need is to show people what it means to be the Yam Segula, what it means to be the Yam HaNivchar. How much do we care about each other? And Rav Shlomo Alkabitz explains that this commemoration of Purim is what Purim is all about. Because that was the story. We started off being a people that were Mefuza or Mefurad, that were just pockets of Jewish communities all over, who really did not care enough about each other. And we ultimately transformed into a people who had a sense of understanding and appreciation of who we are. And that needs to be the takeaway message for all generations. In fact, the last line in the Megillah when we're told about Mordechai. So how would you sum up the accomplishments of Mordechai? So obviously he saved the Jewish people and it was unbelievable what he was able to accomplish and what he did. But Mordechai is described in the last pasuk in the Megillah, not as the heroic, courageous leader who did daring and bold actions in his life, but something very different. The summary of his personality is, Ki Mordechai HaYehudi Mishneh LaMelech Achashverosh, he was a member of Achashverosh's parliament, V'gadol HaYehudim, he was the leader of the Jews, V'ratzui L'rov Achav, and everybody loved him, Doresh Tov La'amo V'dover Shalom L'chol Zaro. What did Mordechai spend his time doing? He was a friendly, affectionate, loving person. He was not a person who just spent his time in the White House, spent his time in Albany and said, I'll mind my own business, I'll do what I need to do. No, he was Dover Shom Nechol Zaro. He was a person who spent his time making sure that people understood how devoted he was to their cause, how much he cared about their lot in life, and how much he was willing to advocate on their behalf. And that is the mission that Mordechai was on in his entire life. And that is what we all need to think about every year as we experience Purim as well. The Chafetz Chaim was well known as a personality who lived a life believing in the possibility of a geula. There are so many stories in which the Chafetz Chaim showed how much he believed that this was a realistic possibility in his life. So it's well known that the Chafetz Chaim did not have furniture in his home. A very bare home, and it's not because he couldn't afford it. The Chafetz Chaim owned a store, he made a parnasa on his own, but the reason why he didn't have furniture is because he said with all sincerity, why would I invest in furniture if I'm going to have to move to Eretz Yisrael tomorrow and I won't be able to take it? It's such a waste. So why would I buy it? I couldn't bring myself to sign the contract on buying my house here. I said to myself, I'm about to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in a property in Chutz Laretz. Am I out of my mind? Am I insane? It should be hard for us to do. Yes, when you agree to do construction on your house, if you need it, great. If you don't need it, you're out of your mind. We're not going to be here forever. The Shulchan Aruch talks about what kind of houses we're allowed to build in Chutz Laretz. We're told you're not allowed to build a brick home. There's a reason for that. Building a brick home shows we don't believe that we're ever going to leave this place. It means we're nisyashu min ha-geula. It means we don't have a Jewish pride. It means we don't believe that there's anything greater than the experience we're having here now in Chutz Laretz. This is not where we belong. So we have a great life, and we're blessed to have the opportunity to live with religious freedoms, but we need to realize that Geula has to be an aspiration for every Jew in Galus, for every Jew in exile. It's what all of us dream for, it's what we daven for every day, it's what we talk about so much, it's what has kept the Jewish people alive all these years. And the Chafetz Chaim, I once read a letter that he wrote, that there were two businessmen in his community in Radin, in Europe, and they were opening a store, a business venture together. And they came up with every possible stipulation that you can imagine. And they put it into the contract. And after they were finished, as two good Jews do, they bring the contract to the Chafetz Chaim. And they asked him to review it to make sure that everything was based on the Psakim and Shulchan Aruch. And he starts reading through it and he sees how they came up with every possible scenario that you can ever imagine. So what happens if there's a flood and all the merchandise gets ruined? Who takes the hit? And what happens if your wife gets sick and you have to take care of her, or my wife gets sick? What happens if one of us die? What happens if our spouses die? What happens if I have to move because I get remarried? And what happens if there's a hurricane and the whole store blows down? And what happens? All kinds of things, all kinds of provisions that were put into this contract. Everything was drawn up. Chafetz Chaim began to cry. And he said, "This is very unfortunate. Because nowhere in here does it say what happens when Mashiach will come, the store is going to close, and we're both going to move to Eretz Yisrael. What do we do then? That is less of a realistic possibility to you than a hurricane coming, blowing down your store, destroying the merchandise, than your wife dying, than my wife dying, than me having to move out of the town. Experiencing a geula and going back to Eretz Yisrael is less of a possibility in your mind as a Jew than that. That's sad." And writes the Chafetz Chaim, he felt, Karav Hadavar Me'od, he says, "My feeling is, I just have a sense, Shazmanenu Hu Ikvasa de Meshicha," this is 100 years ago, he writes, "we are inching so much closer to the times of the coming of Mashiach." And he says, at this time, we have to obviously come together as a people, Ulaharbos Shalom B'Yisrael. Our call now is to be Marbe Shalom B'Yisrael, explains the Chafetz Chaim. We were, the privilege of being in Eretz Yisrael was taken away from us because of Sinas Chinam. Writes the Chafetz Chaim, it's obvious and clear that the only way to be worthy once again is by being Marbe Avas Yisrael, is by understanding what it means to love other people who may not be exactly like us. It's to appreciate what we are as a Jewish people. That is the Tzav HaShaah. That is what it was in the days of Mordechai ve'Esther, as they were trying to experience a geula. And it is the message and it is the expectation of all of us today as well. You know, last week, I say you know, you don't know, but last Matzah Shabbos, last Sunday, I was called by a few people who were part of Hatzalah Air. And I was asked to join them on a mission to Moldova. I'll be honest, I was terrified to be a part of that. I really didn't know whether it's safe to go. And I asked them, what exactly am I going to do there? Why would I go? If it's just to peel potatoes, which is a very noble thing to do, I said, I can send plenty of people who are very interested in going and who are a lot more daring than I am. But they said, no, we want you to come as a rabbi because there are hundreds of Jewish refugees there. We want you to speak to them as they cross the border. We want you to speak to them in a shul there. United Hatzalah had gotten a whole group of them together, a few hundred refugees together. And we want you to communicate with them in Hebrew and to give chizuk. Logistically, it didn't work out. But I was in touch with them as they were there. And I was asking them what they were seeing, what was happening. And when they came back, they told me that the most powerful thing that they experienced was as they were standing by the border between Moldova and Ukraine, they said that there were two people there in yellow jackets. These were representatives of the Foreign Ministry of Israel with two big Israeli flags emblazoned on their jackets. And they said those were the only people from a foreign country to be found at the border. The only ones. Not a single representative of any other country was willing to be there on the border of Moldova and Ukraine. And they said that when they saw that, there was nothing that was more powerful than that statement alone. That this is how Jews live. We walk directly into the problem and we do whatever we can to fix it. And they said that those people stopped every single refugee coming through, did not ask them whether they were Jewish, asked them, do you need a place to go? The first question was not, are you Jewish? The first question was, do you need a place to go? Do you need refuge? They were asked in response, don't you care whether someone's Jewish or not? The reaction that they gave was, 80 years ago there was a selection. We don't need to make selections now. We care about people. And that was so powerful to me, that the only people who show that they care as much as needs to be is our people. It's a powerful statement. It's what all of us need to be thinking about and doing. It's what all of us need to be considering. I'm sure everybody at this point has seen or heard the speech that Natan Sharansky gave at a Sheva Brachas, and I thank you, Lori, for bringing it to my attention before others. And Natan Sharansky describes how 50 years ago, the worst possible thing you can have on your passport was that it was stamped Jewish. Because that meant you had no freedoms, it meant you couldn't go to university, it meant that you would be persecuted behind the Iron Curtain, and everything that that came along with. And he said, at this point in history, there is no greater gift that you can give a person than to stamp Jew on their passport. Because everybody knows that there is no one who will care for you more than another Jew who sees that word Jew stamped on your passport. That is where Jewish history is up to now. It's where world history is. And we ask ourselves, just like Mordechai asked himself, what is the Tzav HaShaah? What is the expectation of every Jew living in our world and our society today? And it's clear to me, I don't think it should be a secret to any of us, that this is the Tzav HaShaah. How much are we willing to show, not just to feel, but how much are we willing to show with action that we really care to invest in the special sense of being part of the Am Segula? How much does Jewish pride and Jewish identity mean to us? How much is Geula a possibility in our lives, and how much are we willing to invest to make sure that the Jewish people all feel that they can be a part of that dream and that aspiration? And as we read the Megillah this Purim, I hope that we will have the opportunity to celebrate V'nahafachu, that all of the tragedy going on in our world will be able to be reversed, and we'll have the opportunity to show HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we do sincerely care, that we are genuinely interested, that we are doing everything we possibly can to show our sense of appreciation for being a part of the Am HaNivchar and the part of the Am Segula. I wish everyone a Purim Sameach.